It's 6 o'clock. I'm going to call to order the Planning Commission for Tuesday, March 20th, 2018. We can have a roll call, please.
Commissioner Valor Plante-Ping?
Here.
Commissioner Mack?
Here.
Commissioner Shiro?
Here.
Lon George is absent. And Chair Martin?
Here. And the flag salute, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Next item on the agenda is for the review of the agenda. Does the commission want to revise the order or make any other amendments to the agenda at this point?
I'd like to make a suggestion that 7B be looked at separately.
Okay.
On the consent agenda.
Okay. We can do that. Any other questions or comments on the agenda? Very good. Now open for the community comments and suggestions. This is the public comment period. It is an invitation of members of the community to present issues, thoughts, and suggestions on matters not scheduled on this agenda. There's no one in the audience here tonight, so I'm not going to go through the rest of my little ditty to explain what that is. If had there been anyone wanting to speak, they would have been invited to come up at this time for items that are not scheduled on tonight's agenda. For staff, are there any other correspondence or supplemental information for our meeting tonight?
None this evening.
Okay, very good. The next are the two items on the consent agenda. We will handle them separately. The first is item 7A, the approval of the minutes. Hoping my fellow commissioners have reviewed the minutes of the meeting of Tuesday, March 6th. I will entertain a motion.
Chair, I move that we approve the approval of the minutes.
Second.
For the March 6th, 2018 meeting.
We have a motion and a second for approval.
Second.
We have 2 seconds now for the meeting. We have a roll call vote for the approval, please.
Commissioner Mack?
Yes.
Commissioner Shiro?
Yes.
Commissioner Fowler Payne?
Yes.
And Chair Martin?
Yes. Okay, the minutes for the meeting of March 6th have been approved. The second item is a consideration certificate of compliance 18001 at 529 Crown Hill. The applicant is Benjamin Hall. We have this memorandum sitting here in front of us. Prior to questions, does staff want to make a brief review of that item in front of us before you take questions from the commission?
Yeah, certainly. I kind of anticipated some questions on this one because typically when you have condition or certificates of compliance, the general rule is if it was legally subdivided at the time, there's not a whole lot we can do about it. This one is one that makes you go, isn't there something we can do about this? Turns out we did write the report. We had our city attorney's office review these materials that were submitted. It does turn out that they were subdivided in compliance with the rules and regulations in place at the time. And so the certificate of compliance, therefore, should be approved. There's a couple of concerns that staff had raised, namely access. So are the lots back in the back now considered to be landlocked? There's an immediate desire, well, if they're all under one ownership, let's go ahead and require the access to be put in place. Again, we can't condition certificates of compliance. They're either approved or denied. But that being said, if they are to be developed or remodeled or changed in any way, shape, or form, even if they are substandard lots in terms of lot size or lot width or lot depth, they still have to meet all of today's current zoning standards. So lot coverage, setbacks, they will be required at the time that any building permit comes in to prove that they have legal access to those back lots. And we are encouraging the applicant outside of the formal approval process of this project to put correct access easements in place for this project. So That's a brief overview of it. Again, it is recommended based on the fact that it was legally subdivided at the time the rules and regulations were in place that the Planning Commission adopt a resolution approving the certificate of compliance. But more than happy to answer questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Downing. Are there questions of the staff on this item?
I do.
Well, yeah.
We don't, you know, first of all, the map that they submitted is inadequate. Doesn't have the lot numbers on it, so, you know, you have to kind of research it. The other, the 100-foot strip that goes down, which is actually lot 66 and 65, and that's not called out in the legal description. When you read the, on parcel 5, it's only a non-exclusive easement for utilities. It doesn't, on 65, doesn't even call out 66. The legal description for the lot 21 is inappropriate. You can't just say the west 26.36 feet of lot 21 of block 28. You have the legal description for that actually becomes that remainder portion of lot 26 as documented by whatever took the other 10 feet. So that legal description is incorrect also.
Certainly, so I can address some of those comments. So you're bringing up a lot of the issues that we would identify when they're going to actually record the certificate of compliance for entitlement purposes. There is more information that has been presented. There's a lot of background information that based on the fact that the city wasn't even a city at the time of subdivision, we didn't feel at the time was necessary. But you are bringing up things that engineering will be double-checking when the act to make sure that it actually does comply with all the legal requirements of the Subdivision Map Act when they record their certificate of compliance.
Well, I'd like to see it come back to us corrected and legal, not just as a consent agenda item, because there's just too many errors and flaws in this. The maps that we got weren't even legible. I had to use a magnifying glass to see that. But I have a feeling that they're landlocked. I don't think that access, that 25-foot access along there that backs up to Crown Hill is even legal without reading the document, because it just says for an easement. Doesn't say for access, for a utility easement. So this doesn't fall just under the City Planning Department guidelines. This is the Subdivision Map Act for the state.
Correct.
Doing certification. And the exhibit that was presented was completely deficient of what was required by the state guidelines. So I'd like to see it come back, maybe make the comments to whoever prepared it, have it reviewed by survey department or an engineer at the county or the city, and then come back to us for approval. I just can't vote in favor of this at this point.
Well, I can tell you that the city engineering department, who will, again, be reviewing all the fine detailed stuff when they actually do come in to record the certificate of compliance after this entitlement process, has reviewed it and does not have an issue with it and does find that they are legal lots.
Well, I've done enough certificates myself that when a request for a certificate is brought forward, it's brought forward with a new legal description and the exhibit map showing the distances, and this is, you know, an unacceptable submittal. So
basically it's diagrammatic at best, but My question is, why isn't this agendatized and people notified, and why is this coming as a consent agenda and not a public hearing item?
So because our municipal code does not require public hearings for certificates of compliance. They either are legal lots or they are not. And there's no public hearing necessary to determine that. It's either did they comply with the subdivision requirements in place at the time, and yes, they have.
My issue is we're looking at a map that's probably over 100 years old here, and we can't read it, number one. And I guess we would like to have the opportunity to evaluate whether it's legal or not, too. What I see before us doesn't work, number one. You have four lots way behind a bigger lot in the front, and from emergency access standpoint and the fire department standpoint, and making it a safe subdivision or safe lots to access from a public street, we need more input. We don't know what easements were recorded on other lots that should have probably punched out to the street to the rear or off to another. There should be two ways in and out, and there should be more, in my mind, access to these other lots to make them safe. And we don't know whether that was in place at the time or not.
But that's so great point. The fire department and the police department have both reviewed this as well. So we review this as the staff advisory committee. So that's the heads of planning, building, engineering, police, fire, and public works. Again, at the rules that were in place and the requirements to subdivide land at the time that the land was subdivided, back in the late 1800s, they did meet all the requirements at that time. And that's all we can do from a certificate of compliance standpoint.
But as development goes on and the other lots around it start building, they're landlocking this thing in, not knowing possibly they were supposed to leave additional access or utility easements to these possible certificates of compliance.
Well, the other thing, too, is, you know, I agree that this is a legal map. I've looked at this on other projects. Lot 21, because it's a remainder of Lot 21, we don't have a legal description there to verify that that was legally created according to the matrix that's outlined by the county and the state. So we don't know that. The other thing is, on this map, you can't read the notes when that street was abandoned. Do these notes say that it was owned by the city or it was owned by a HOA or was it created as a lot? If so, that goes back to each adjacent parcel owner. It doesn't come back as a lump sum lot. And not having a copy of the abandonment of that street to read, we don't have anything to verify that either. Only that our staff report says it's legal, but
correct. So again,
I don't want to certify something.
All of the information that has been reviewed by our engineering professionals in the engineering division, they all recommend that, yes, this is a legally subdivided land.
Well, that doesn't mean that we can't review that. I just like to see it brought back a more accurate package with a map that's labeled where the lots are, because this map doesn't, you know, I sat down and figured it out with a magnifying glass, which one was which lot. And they don't even call out Lot 66 at 65, but there's two lots there. So the legal description that's given on the back of this is incorrect to start with. And if somebody's reviewed it in the engineering department, they should have picked up on that.
Again, but that's a recordation review that you're talking about. So the legal descriptions, yes, they might not be 100% accurate on attachment 3, but that is a correction that goes back to them when they go to record the map. So this, for the entitlement purposes, was adequate enough information to say, yes, we can follow all the dots or follow all the breadcrumbs and determine that these were legally subdivided.
You're saying the planning department is saying that they have followed the guidelines for planning, but this is a Subdivision Map Act issue, and they aren't consistent with the guidelines of the Map Act. This map that's presented is inadequate.
No, what I'm saying is the engineering division has also reviewed it and says that it is legal.
Well,
they cannot walk out after this meeting and record this as it stands, because they will have to make revisions and things.
I'd like to see it brought back to us with the correct legal description and exhibit on it. I don't know if anybody else feels that way. But
well, I kind of do. Something just feels awry here. It doesn't. You know, we're approving lots that first are smaller than what our code requires. You're saying this one lot
our
is 36
current
feet, or 36 feet wide by 66 feet long.
You keep going back to our current code, and this is an approval of the rules back in 18 whatever. And so they're saying, you're right, if it was by today's rules, we couldn't have this track.
Well, their certificates of compliance are, okay,
it's
how
either
many parcels
was
you
then
have, how
at
many
that
entitlements
time, or
you
wasn't.
Yeah, but what we're doing a certificate of compliance is now saying it does certify.
Not for today's rules. We're certifying by the rules then. That's all we're saying.
But you've got a 26-foot lot that's a remainder of another parcel, and that's not consistent.
And now we're going to decide based on none of the information that was not a submittal for something that comes before us. They gave us a couple of glimpses of documents, not near, I'm sure, what they actually looked at. So, which is typical for a certificate of compliance.
Oh, no, it isn't. I did 483 up at Hearst Ranch, and this wouldn't even got in the door to be looked at the county.
All right, well.
And the thing is, a certificate of compliance doesn't necessarily describe the meets and bounds of the property lines. And now what you have is four substandard lot sizes with one huge lot that looks like it might be an acre or so.
And you're talking about, again, substandard for today's laws.
That's correct. Okay. But when the certificate of compliance that they're asking for did not have meets and bounds and boundaries information on those lots. These lot lines are just now being created today, before us now. I don't see these lots on this map, this old map. This is now being generated with verbiage from an engineer saying, this is what we're proposing to do to meet with those certificates that we're entitled to. These lots can be much bigger, and still get the same amount of certificates of compliance, but bigger lots.
We could sit here and argue with this. I'd just like to see it come back with an accurate documentation that validates the parcels, and this map not being able to read what the abandonment of the road and who it was abandoned to. What it was either abandoned as a whole, or it had, generally when a road is abandoned, it's abandoned back to the adjacent parcel. So therefore it wouldn't have been this one long leg. It would have gone back to each one of those lots, which is 15, 17, 19, and 21, and it's not showing it here. I can't validate that because it doesn't. When you look at this 6x6 map, and this map was probably, a 42-inch map, you can't read any of this legal. Even with magnifying glass, I couldn't read any of it to see who was a legal owner of the roads. And so unless you have that information, you can't make a valid decision whether those parcels are correct. I know parcel 21 isn't.
So this is a point where are we going to do staff's work? Cause
no, I want them to bring it back correctly.
But, I mean, do they not have that information, Matt?
I've got some questions. I've been drafting here to try to see if we can get a little bit of focus on what's happening here. My first question is not really directly related to some of the historical stuff going on here, but is the owner planning on some development of some kind of these particular parcels that you're aware of?
At this time, no. Obviously, if you venture up there, you'll see that there's a kind of a spread of different buildings that are already in existence. We have no formal development plans on those lots at this time.
And that does the, and I'm trying to get a grasp on the scope of our true responsibilities. I mean, I understand and certainly recognize and agree that the quality of the information and the thoroughness of the information is incomplete by today's standards, may even been incomplete by standards of 30 or 40 years ago. But does the certificate of compliance grant them any other rights or privileges? As far as the what I'm going to call the modern or current planning or development rules and regulations?
Depends on the exact, what right you're referring to. So by establishing, yes, these were legally subdivided at the time that this map was recorded, they could potentially come in and request building permits for the legally recognized lots. again, at that time, all of the current zoning standards would need to be met, so height, lot coverage, floor area ratio, setbacks, that type of thing. They'd also have to prove that they have legal access to those lots at that time. We unfortunately can't require them to do that at this moment with the certificate of compliance.
So the certificate of compliance is a limited in scope document. It is not really granting any, other development rights, nor is it expected to really be including easement rights or utility rights or things along that line, or
it's acknowledging that the subdivision of land was correct at the time that it was done.
Okay. Are there any existing structures that are going across any of the property lines that are being established under this
yes.
request?
I was there today, yeah.
Where's the north on here? So kind of the north western two lots, there is a building. It is unclear at this moment if that property line is running between the two buildings that look like they are connected, and if the intent there is to basically condo that building into two separate units. But there is definitely the large P-shaped lot, that main front lot, that's all being established as one and not all the individuals, does have a large single-family residence on it that covers, I would say, at least three, if not four, of those lot lines.
Okay. And then my last question is, I'm hearing a desire to see additional documentation and additional detail to validate this map or validate some of the, I'll say, measurements and things of that nature. There are a couple of issues that have been raised by these commissioners. Is that part of our responsibility as a planning commission to do that? Or, what's really the scope of our, is it appropriate for us to be requesting these particular changes in a document or a request of this kind? Or is this really, some of us exceeding the authority that the Planning Commission has on making this decision?
No, I certainly, I think in this instance, there is a lot more information in the file that is not in your staff report because it was previously reviewed. However, if it's the will of the commission to see that information, by all means, we can provide that at a future meeting. And, if there's a desire, as Commissioner Fowler Payne pointed out, to have a more schematic or diagrammatic rather than just kind of depiction of the lots, then we can request that be provided as well. Ultimately, it is, from staff's perspective, was it legally subdivided at the time? Did they follow all the rules in place when it was subdivided, yes or no? But it is still an action by the Planning Commission, so you still have to adopt the resolution. And if the majority of the Planning Commission is not comfortable adopting that resolution at this moment and would like additional information, by all means, we can bring that back.
Yeah, at the end of the staff report, it gives us alternatives of the actions that we can do.
Right, and I understand that. I'm just trying to, if we don't need to be discussing this for another 20 minutes and posing questions, I prefer not to.
No, I would love to have the applicant here and explain his point of view of why he thinks he can do a 23-foot wide lot.
Is this so? Is that true? These lines are being drawn right now, or they were drawn then?
They were drawn back in the late 1800s.
Yeah, this is not a new line. This is a line that was
not the remainder. Not the remainder.
There's a remainder parcel that we don't have the identification as to how that parcel was created. There's a matrix that you go by under the MAP Act that tells you different times how a parcel can be created. We do not know whether lot 21 was created consistent with the matrix guidelines that's set forth by the Subdivision Map Act that says that's a legal parcel.
Matt, are you saying that you don't know that, or staff looked into that and came to the conclusion that it was?
Yes, engineering division staff did look into
that. So you're just saying that you don't believe staff.
But
I would like to see it documented. I don't want to certify something that, you're just saying something.
What advantage would staff have of approving it when they didn't look into it? I
want to see it.
I'm going to entertain a motion that we table this item to a date certain to give staff and the applicant an opportunity to address some of these outstanding issues and provide some clarity rather than berate this, if that's an appropriate.
Certainly, the only comment I would make is, since it's not a public hearing, as required by the municipal code, you don't have to make it a date certain. You can just continue it to a future meeting.
I'm happy to provide that kind of flexibility on the agendizing of our meetings and to.
And then you can put it on the non-public hearing items, correct?
I could. Again, typically, being that it's more of a somewhat ministerial issue, that's why we are putting it on the consent agenda. But we could look at putting it on the non-public hearing items, yes.
And then if we can get a full-size 24 by 36 or something sheet of that little map.
Are you turning that into a motion?
I'm happy to include that in the motion. I made it generic enough that there, and I was going to, once we had a motion and a second, which we don't have it yet, but my intent was to provide some direction for staff on the types of items that we would like to see.
Commissioner Mack, did you want the 24 by 36 of the original subdivision?
That's correct.
I'd like to see a more detailed.
Can we get a motion to table this item? And
yeah, I'm making a motion to table this item and move it to the next available Planning Commission meeting as a non-public hearing item with items to include an enlarged map, more information from staff's file that has the language of the certificates of compliance, and that also includes the exhibit here properly labeled, and that would match up with the legal descriptions that are shown on the back of the sheet here, being page attachment 3. If there's excerpts from the MAP Act that need to be included with the matrix that Fowler Plain had indicated, if you can provide copies of the excerpts from the MAP Act.
Is there a second for that?
Second it.
Very good. We have a motion and a second.
Just for staff's clarification, Commissioner Mack, you were you're looking to tie on your properly labeled exhibit, you're looking to tie attachment 1 to attachment 3, correct?
That's correct. Okay.
Are there any other questions or additions for this for staff?
No.
Okay. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Commissioner Mack?
Yes.
Commissioner Fowler Payne?
Yes.
Commissioner Shiro?
No.
Commissioner Martin?
Yes. With that, item 7B is continued. Next item on our agenda is a public hearing, and there are no public hearing items on tonight's agenda. So we're going to proceed to item 9A. Our first non-public hearing item is consideration of the 2017 General Plan Annual Report. Mr. Downing, do you have a report for us on this?
I do, and while we wait for the PowerPoint to go up. All right, so thank you, Commission. Tonight we're taking a look at the 2017 General Plan Annual Report. You may recall the 2016 annual report coming before you last year. The background of this is it's required by the government code that annually the city provide the office of the governor's office of planning an annual update of what basically we've been working on in order to either update, implement, modify, or change the general plan, as well as looking at other trends in each jurisdiction so that the state knows what's going on in local communities. So the report's required to be sent to OPR by April 1st of every year. The city council, being the legislative body of the city, is the one to make the final adoption and move forward. However, the Planning Commission, being the keepers of the general plan, we bring it to you. It's for your information and review and any comment you have. And just so that you remember going into your Planning Commission training here in the next few weeks, there's 7 required general plan elements. There are land use circulation, housing, conservation, open space, safety, and noise. The city also has several optional elements, that being agriculture, which is included in the open space and conservation element, economic development, which is a standalone element, and the park and recreation element is also optional. So as I mentioned, the annual report is intended to report data to the state on what's going on land use-wise. It also helps to inform local decision makers on areas that either need additional resources to accomplish things like that. It's a factual document. It's not a comprehensive list of everything that we've done throughout the year. We identify some of the major work efforts, and actually I caught one that should have been in there that I didn't put in, and so I'll go over that in a minute. It's not meant to evaluate the work efforts that have been done or are planned to be done, but at least highlight them and kind of help the council prioritize what work needs to happen moving forward. Kind of frustratingly, there's no mandated format. I find things a lot easier when they say, fill this out and give it back to us. So you'll see the format of our document is very similar to last year's. We base that off of several other case cities. The intent of the annual report is not to be elaborate or time-consuming. We're looking at kind of what's the biggest bang for our buck in terms of producing this. And then as we did last year into this year, we'll continue to do this year moving forward, is continuing to build upon these in future years and finding where we can expand certain information and being provided. But for now, for instance, last year's didn't include the housing element tables and attachment C, so that's additional information that we're starting to build upon, and now we know every year we'll start continuing to include that information so you can refer back to it over the years. So some of the major highlights of this general plan annual report, we're still working on that circulation element. We're eyeballing a public review draft in the summer of 2018. There could be some hiccups on that, and I'll highlight those. I'll highlight them now, one being Briscoe, so the project update on Briscoe a little bit later, but that's very exciting, but that's taking a lot of staff resources that would otherwise be going to the circulation element. Additionally, we're currently updating the park and recreation element. That some of the work items associated with that have been to the Parks and Recreation Commission a few different times, including a survey format that went out to kind of gauge the community's need and use of our existing and any potential recreation opportunities. The report also highlights other work efforts that we've been doing over the last year or so. Obviously, the end of 2016 for the Planning Commission and the beginning of 2017 for the Council was the Cherry Avenue specific plan. For staff, following that entitlement has been a lot of the working with the developers on public improvement plans, things like that. Obviously, water shortage restrictions. We got a lot of water last year, but we were still building on the 2016 drought and getting all of our rules and regulations in place in case we ran into that again. Very grateful for the rain that we're receiving right now because it had been a very dry winter up to this point. East Branch streetscaping, so the Planning Commission saw that. The council ended up taking what we've dubbed the kind of pro-parking alternative, which retained as much on-street parking as we could and did get that pedestrian crosswalk in. We're very excited about that. Camp Arroyo Grande, that was a big, granted the public didn't become aware of that until a little bit later. There was a lot of behind-the-scenes work that needed to be done to bring that memorandum of understanding to the council, and so that was a big work effort. And then the one that I forgot to put in this document is the East Grand Avenue Master Plan. So that's the whole work effort we're doing on Grand Avenue. It includes the parking study and all of that, trying to bring all of our documents in line, figure out what incentives we can put in place and or developer assurances to where we get the high-quality infill development that's adequately parked that we're kind of desiring on that corridor. Additionally, planned updates, we keep picking away at the land use element, so the East Grand Avenue Master Plan is a component of that, as well as the safety element. The safety element, A, is required by state law. We were notified after the housing element was certified that there's a couple of things in there we need to look at regarding flooding and wildfires as they affect low-income housing and vulnerable populations of our community, as well as the local hazard mitigation plan. We're currently working on trying to get a countywide hazard mitigation plan grant, which would be a 75% with our countywide 25% match, which is a very, very cost-effective way to do it. So we're working on that. Luckily, we don't have a whole lot of work on that at this moment. It's just kind of sitting there, and somebody else is working on it. But due to all the wildfires last year, it's taking FEMA a little bit longer to get back to us in terms of if we receive that grant. And then some of the recent updates, so the land use map and actually the conservation, agriculture, and open space map associated with the East Cherry Avenue specific plan project. So that's highlighted in there. And then the 2016 housing element was the other most recent general plan update that we've done, and that was certified, like I said, 2016. Now, in terms of environmental review for the annual report, it's exempt from CEQA per the 15061B3, which is the we can guarantee with absolute certainty that producing this annual report will not impact the environment. And the agenda, tonight's agenda was posted in accordance with Government Code Section 54954.2. And we've received, surprisingly, no public comments on this item. Obviously, there's nobody in the audience that's beating down our door demanding information about the general plan annual report. So more than happy to discuss items contained within, any other items the commission would like to discuss. And then, but it's recommended that you receive and file the 2017 annual report, and we'll move that on to council for final acceptance and then send it off to OPR. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Downing. Are there questions about the annual report for staff from the commission at this point?
Can you roll it back to the group there? I didn't see, I mean, we've got the East Branch Street, streetscape, and we've got the camp. But we didn't have anything on the bridge.
Oh.
I know Halcyon's still in a preliminary stage, so it may not show up till next year, but the bridge has been going on for some time, and I don't see it listed on there.
Yeah, and, you know, I didn't include the Bridge Street Bridge mainly because a lot of the work associated with that in the last calendar year was our consultants doing the environmental studies and reports and circulations and things like that, trying to get it to a point where we could actually put that information out to the public. But that wasn't necessarily directly staff time, but that's a good point. It's a reflection of the work
that
the city has done.
I thought that was already determined as to, I mean, there was like three or four different design guidelines or designs for that, and there was a decision made on the one that was going to be utilized. So I would have thought.
And that actually occurred in 2016. Yeah, the years are starting to all blend together in my mind, too.
So with that, it still didn't give us the information as to what the status is, but you're saying it's out.
That's last
year's news.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's no projected time for the work to be done?
I believe they're looking at, this is already 18, I believe they're looking at spring 2019. But don't quote me on that. I'll look into that and provide an update to the commission.
I just have kind of a quick question. Is the format you used this year fairly consistent with what the city used in the past? I would agree that it's a little bit frustrating that the state is not giving you guidelines, but I'm not sure who is reading this, if anyone may be reading this in Sacramento, but
yeah.
I would hope that or assume that there's a consistency from our city's reports year by year. It makes it easier for them to kind of blend them together to make that kind of evaluation on tracking.
Yes, so this is largely similar to what we did last year. I kind of expanded the section on page 9, kind of just south of middle of the page, talking about all the major work efforts that we worked on in the 2017, just trying to highlight that while we didn't do anything necessarily directly modifying a general plan element, we were doing a lot of things associated therewith. So that's kind of an expansion this year, and then the inclusion of all the housing tables and providing that information to them as well.
Okay, very good. Any other questions for for staff?
On the housing element, what is our projected goal for the low-income housing? How many units, and what have we met, or have we met them?
Yeah, so, and luckily, because I knew questions were going to come up on that, since that's a new feature this year, I did talk to our associate planner, Kelly Heffernan, and just kind of refreshed everything in my mind. So, table starting on page 11, you can see all the housing items. And looking at our regional housing needs assessment numbers, our RENA numbers on specifically page 13, the requirements, allocation by land use, so in the very low income for the planning period that the RENA numbers cover, starting in 2014, we're looking at 60 very low units, 38 low number of units, 43 moderate, and then 101 above moderate. Again, these are not units that we are getting built or we're forcing people to build or anything like that. It's looking at the whole segment of the community. We have a certain proportion, and we need to either incentivize or remove obstacles to people developing these. We can't necessarily say, we have enough moderate or above moderate housing, so you have to do all low-income housing. People can still propose projects under the development code. But for instance, this table next year for 2018 in the very low, because of the approval of the house load project, will likely have the additional 20 units there, whether that's 2018 or 2019 when they're actually constructed. So you can see how over time they kind of see, oh, these are the trends. And it also has the information on what things we need to do in order to address the other items in our housing element, such as increasing density in certain zones and things like that. So trying to remove the obstacles moving forward. So I don't know if that answers your question. I realize I kind of rambled on there for a second.
Well, historically, and I've worked on a lot of subdivisions in the last 40 years, but developers were required to provide a percentage of low-income housing with a deed restriction on them and when you're doing multi-units. How come we're not doing that? We're taking the low-income fee.
Yeah.
But is that fee, when nothing's happening, is that fee going to be appropriate for what the rising cost of construction is?
A great question. And I don't necessarily, the tail end of that, I don't necessarily have an answer for. But going back, so yes, our code does require at least four developments of a certain size that a certain number of low income, very low income, or moderate income units be provided. What we found, historically, we used to require those to be built with the project. They'd be deed restricted, et cetera. The problem with those during the economic recession was the deed-restricted income level prices were actually higher than market rate prices. So your low income were actually higher than a moderate or above moderate rental at that time. So therefore, it didn't make economic sense to have the deed restrictions in place when somebody could actually rent something for cheaper. Additionally, the amount of paperwork and administrative costs that it takes to manage all of those is kind of staggeringly high when you actually look at it. And we have to, anytime they want to modify anything, it has to be reviewed by the city, which is an incurred cost. So we found it was more cost efficient to actually, if you'd like to provide these units, great, but if we are given the money, then we're able to do things like help Haslow purchase the land in order to provide, a 20-unit, very low-income housing project. So we're seeing that it does work out kind of to our advantage, and we do see more return on investment by taking the in-lieu fee than actually having the units constructed with the projects.
You know, one of the benefits of having them constructed with the project was, and I know one of the issues through the county when we were doing all this, was you integrate the lower income people in with medium and higher income, so you don't have a low income group,
yeah.
and gives them a little bit more self-esteem. So that's, you know, a very negative when you're taking the fee and not requiring the developers to do that. I think at one time it was 10%. So if you were doing 100 units, 10 of them had to be reserved for low income, and they were restricted with resales, with only a percentage of income for resale. So what they were trying to promote was long-term residents there. So if you did that, it'll eliminate a lot of the paperwork and time frame. But I think that integrating the lower-income people with the nicer, I mean, they didn't have, it wasn't a low-income home built, but they were a different class of people living next door to you, but it kind of built their self-esteem too.
Yeah, certainly, and that's definitely something that, you know, in the planning circles we do talk a lot about it. Getting that variety of housing types and income levels is usually creates more complete neighborhoods and projects. Exactly. Again, going back to just the economics of it, when the recession hit, we lost a lot of units because they were more costly to rent them, to have the deed restriction on them, to then to rent them at market rate.
But we're not in that recession, and you know, there's two large ones that we've approved here in the last 3 years, and there hasn't been any mention of, you know, providing low-income housing in those. I mean, they make the comment that they're going to make them affordable, but $500,000 is not affordable.
Yeah, and that's... Yeah,
I would like to see that come back into play, that those houses be required, or not required, but I know they still have the option, but
yeah.
we still
definitely encourage it. We encourage at least the variety of housing types and mixing of unit sizes and bedrooms and things like that to provide at least a greater option for folks. So we definitely still encourage developers to do that, but like I said, you know, we've been able to get projects like People Self-Help Housing, and we just found that the return on the investment, rather than getting one here, two here, but to actually get multiple units in at one time, at this time, is a better return on investment. But yeah,
you create a specific housing element there. I know I've worked on several very large ones, and the incentive that was given to the developer to provide those, that percentage in an overall subdivision, was a reduction of the building permit fees. So they do have incentives to do that, and I think that helps us meet our quota. It integrates the people, so you don't, and I don't want to use this word, but it avoids creating slum areas, because I hate to say that, but when you put 20 or 30 low-income people together, you end up with an area that's going to become low-income. And it's not the same as dispersing people and giving them that self-pride in what they have for ownership.
And we're very fortunate that we, in recent years, particularly like the Haslow Project and People's Self-Help Housing Project, we're getting the housing projects that are managed very well to address that issue.
Yeah, I understand that. I've worked on.
Well, that's the other projects I've been involved in. They have the inclusionary housing with the proposed subdivision, so you can't tell whether it's an affordable unit. It looks like all the other units, there's just a deed restriction on it. There's a certain percentage that's approved with the development that has to occur. My question's more, you know, between, and thank you about the Bridge Street and the housing, I had similar questions, but A3.1 through A3.3, are we currently in compliance with the state mandate? Is our development code currently in compliance?
Give me 1 second to review these.
Because, and then it gets down to your format again. Do we really want to say that this program is continuing ongoing? Like, I guess what I'm saying is when are we going to be in compliance? When are we going to bring our development code up to comply with what's required by the state and start passing this requirement on to the developers?
Well, in the we do... So at this time, I don't have necessarily an answer on when will we be in compliance with the state. Obviously, we have certain time frames of when things are supposed to be implemented in the housing element. And I can tell you from when you're in the midst of updating the housing element and you get going and there's a lot of motivation behind, yeah, we're going to do this in this amount of time, and you kind of forget all the other work that you're neglecting. Unfortunately, right now, there's too much work for the number of personnel we have. So it does become a priority thing, and that is something that we've looked at previously in terms of, okay, which ones of these are kind of the low-hanging fruit, kind of the easy, easy being a relative term, but easy code amendments where it says specifically here, thou shall update this way, and that we can bring forward to the Planning Commission. So we've identified some of those. We continue to kind of work on them. Kelly's our housing guru, so she typically is the one burdened by, again, burden being a relative term, she's typically the one bringing the housing policies and things forward, and she's been backlogged with a lot of other either water-related things or climate action plan-related items. She's our programs person. So we do continue to try and bring that stuff forward and catch up. And this, you know, absolutely is one of those times when we go, well, are we falling short of that goal? You know, we might be a year behind on some of these, in which case, okay, we need to pick it up, and maybe it's Kelly and myself, or maybe we get we have a great resource at Cal Poly, being that they have a undergrad and master's program. Maybe we get an intern in that can generate a development code amendment or something like that, and then we can bring that for review it, obviously, and bring it forward. So it gives you kind of the opportunity to look at things like that and fit those in. Ultimately, we work on entitlements because there's the Streamlining Act and whatever council prioritizes. And so we attack things as best we can.
Yeah, I'm just, because we want to be in compliance, obviously.
Yeah.
But when the way the format, I mean, how many years in a row are we going to say the same thing before the state goes, well, you really haven't done anything yet? That's my concern, is that we show that we are doing something.
Yeah, and luckily there's no, we're the reporting is not for them to say, well, you haven't been meeting your targets. Those are targets that the city has put in place on itself. But there are some things, like state law, where they say, thou shalt.
Exactly.
Yeah, thou shalt include this extremely low housing definition, which we should be doing, and we should bring our code into compliance. And it's like our accessory dwelling unit ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
We basically had to match the state, and until we did, we had to match the state. So there is some instances of that, the no timeline on when we'll be in full compliance, but also there's no. It's also hard to, and if you listen to city council meetings recently, you'll hear a lot of unfunded mandate bashing. So we get to it as quickly as we can, and without additional resources from the state to do it, it becomes one of those things that we try and prioritize it, but the community has other priorities for us as well.
I just have one question on this A3.3. When a developer is coming in with a project, a subdivision, you know, of a larger size, are we bringing these incentives up to them, or are we just getting the subdivision and that's what we're running? I know, you know, we're not there to design their projects, but are we dwelling on this where we've got this amended development code where we're letting them know that, you know, you have these incentives if you do provide you know, if you do provide those low-income housing, it's not the incentives would offset the loss of revenue that they would get if they didn't have it, and yet we would be meeting our guidelines and increasing the lower-income housing integrated through those developments. I know I've worked on 208-lot subdivision called Hidden Pines, and we did 10%. So that was, you know, 20 units or 20-something units, but it was a phased map, so we didn't have to do them all at one time. We integrated them through the four phases, so it was only like five, but they got through the city of Santa Maria, but they got benefits, and it didn't, the cost was reduced to, and Santa Maria's pricing is a little different than here too, but it came out almost equivalent to what they would have sold them for if had they not had the low-income housing restriction on them. So I'm just saying, are we even bringing this up?
Yeah, when we can. So that's why we always, for any developer who's out there listening right now, we encourage you to do your pre-applications, get your plans in early, let us provide comments and things like that. In fact, the pre-application that came through the Planning Commission, I believe it was last year over on Pilgrim Way with all the residential development behind a church, that's a perfect example of something where we've tried to address some of these needs and, well, you can do this. What we're finding for a large majority of the industry, even though construction costs are high and continuing to increase, the return on the investment is still higher with market rate houses, even taking into consideration a lot of the incentives. That's why we're seeing the authorities in affordable housing bringing those projects forward.
Not change the subject, but we did do that pre-application for the church over there. Have they ever come back? And I talked with him once before.
No, we haven't received a formal application.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I wonder if there are any other questions on the annual report. If not, I guess the appropriate thing would be to say, you know, thank you for sharing with us. You know, certainly, as you hand this over and present it to City Council, you may take an opportunity to highlight a couple of the comments and issues that were raised here tonight in our comments with this annual report.
My only concern, and it's to staff on the format, is the column that says time frame. And then a lot of these boxes, you're not giving us a time frame. You're saying ongoing, which you gave me a great explanation why. I'm just not sure.
I want to use
that verbiage.
I see your point. So the time frame is actually directly from the housing element itself. So each of those action items does say give a time frame. So that is not us saying here's our time frame of when we think this is what the housing element says. Hey, within 2 years you should have this done. But I don't know if I misunderstood your original point or if I misunderstood this point.
Yeah, I'm not sure labeling it as time frame would be serving a purpose.
Yeah.
I have just one quick question.
To move forward.
Okay. As far as the sites for affordable housing, who selects those? What's the process for that? Is that ever reviewed by Planning Commission, or is that just all staff level?
I'd have to go back and talk to Kelly about that and how we did it last time.
Have those remained the same?
Generally, those haven't changed yet.
Okay.
What we're seeing from the state level, at least, on when we're updating the housing elements and we have these opportunity sites, as they're called, is they're getting a little more serious in terms of you can't just point to a lot and go, yeah, we could, based on square footage, we could put 20 extra units over there. You actually have to put thought into, yes, based on density, you could put 20 units there, but how do you do it? Is it really feasible to do that based on any number of things like parking or setbacks, all that type of stuff? So they are getting a little bit more stringent on how realistic are your opportunity sites within your housing element.
I have one more question. Do we have a ceiling on those vacation houses? I mean, do we have a ceiling as the maximum that we're going to allow within our city jurisdictional boundaries? Because to me, when you're repeatedly issuing those vacation, we've cut back on the rental properties, and you know, how is that going to affect us if we don't have a ceiling on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't have a specific, you know, there's only 25 maximum. We do have the distance limitation, so there can't be one within 300 feet of another one. Yeah. But when you look at our total 5.5 square miles of city, you can fit quite a few in there. So that's definitely something that we've, at first it was a mixed, we weren't seeing very many applications, and it was a mixed balance of vacation rentals and homestays, again, homestays being where you're renting out a room or two in your house on a short-term basis. Then last year, I think it was last year, unless I'm, again, blending 2016 together, we did see the increase significantly of vacation rentals. And that was very concerning, and that's part of that housing element policy of monitoring that number. I did ask our GIS technician how many we have currently. We have 27 total rentals, permitted rentals, I should say, because there's definitely some out there that are not permitted. But those are still fairly balanced with about three or four more vacation rentals than homestays. So we're keeping an eye on it. We don't have a metric of is this a critical thing, but we are keeping an eye on it, and kind of when we get a little uncomfortable. That was one thing that the council did. They didn't require us to come back with a status report, but they did say keep an eye on that per the general plan. So.
Well, because, you know, every time we've had one come through on our green sheet, I go there to see it, and I've noticed that the majority, actually all of them, because I haven't seen one in a million-dollar neighborhood, they're all in the lower rental income neighborhood. So to me, that was my question. I think that's taking away from the rentals, which are more affordable for some people. And I can understand people are wanting to do these vacation rentals. They're going to make more money, and, you know, they're happy, but they're also the ones that say, my kids can't afford to live here. So, what do you know, I would like to see some kind of a ceiling put on that so that we don't have an over influx of them and cut back on our rentals. We're going to be hurting. That's all I have to say.
Very good. I think that's it for the. Do you have another comment on the.
No, I just have a motion.
There's no motion required. There's no action that's required on this item.
Okay.
I'm just presenting it for our information only.
Even better.
And I did want to advise what I will be doing on the significant work items that we've been working on in the last year. I will, before this goes to council next week, I will add the East Grand Avenue Master Plan to that list. So I wanted to advise the commission on that.
Very good.
Does this report, I mean, we've been asking for this for 3 years, about the parking situation. Does this general plan annual report, does it take into consideration our request for a reevaluation of the parking on a project? I mean, I didn't see it included in this.
No, because this is a report of what we've been doing in the last year. That's why I brought up the East Grand Avenue Master Plan, which the council directed to include that, the request for parking study. So that's been folded into the East Grand Avenue Master Plan. That's why I want to put it in there, because, yeah, that's a work item that should be highlighted in this document that I just didn't think of at the time.
Okay.
Accidental oversight. I'm glad you caught that. Thank you. Very good. The next item on our agenda is election of officers for the Planning Commission for next year. Now's the time for us to elect the presiding officers to run the meetings from April of this year into March of next year. The process that we go through is to seek nominations. We don't require any seconds to these nominations. And then once the nominations have been exhausted, we'll close those nominations and vote, and we'll separate between the chair and the vice chair. So at this point,
can we entertain the idea of having Lon here of
this? And tabling this until all five commissioners?
Yeah, that's.
I'm happy to do that. It might be. Is there a reason to avoid that, or a reason to proceed tonight?
My comment to that would be: it is in your bylaws that you will do this at this meeting of every year. So I'll just give that as advisement, not directing or suggesting one way or the other.
I'd like to proceed. If we can't get a majority vote on a change, I think then we will proceed and just we'll delay it if we can't get that. If we can get that tonight, I think we can just proceed. I agree. I would much prefer that she was here with us tonight.
But can we do both in one motion?
No.
Then you got to do separately?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We start with chair?
Yes.
I'd like to make a motion.
It's not a motion. You just want to nominate someone.
I'd like to nominate Glenn Martin as chair.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to nominate John Mack as chair.
Okay.
And maybe Glenn as vice chair.
We'll handle vice chair as a separate item on here.
We've had a rotation. We had Glenn on there and then you, so I think maybe having another person on as chair for the remainder of the year.
Are there any other nominations? We will close the nominations.
Is there a motion to close the nominations?
Do we need a motion to close?
Yes.
Oh, we do need a motion to close. I'll entertain a motion to close nominations.
I'll make a motion to close the nominations.
Is there a second?
Second.
Do we have to? We're going to vote on closing the nominations at this point. It seems to be fairly cumbersome to me at this point, I guess, a little bit.
Indeed, it's a procedural remnant.
Far be it from me to stand in the way of historical procedural remnants.
You can do a simple majority voice vote rather than a roll call vote on the closing of the nomination.
So we'd be just on the chair?
All in favor,
I
got one of those.
Just the chair.
Just
closing the nomination period.
Oh, yeah, the chair. All those in favor of closing the nomination, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Thank you. The nominations are closed.
So for, if you'd like, I can take over on the...
Why don't you go ahead and do that at this point?
So on the nomination of Glenn Martin proceeding as chair for the Planning Commission, can we get a roll call vote, Debbie?
Commissioner Fowler Payne?
No.
Commissioner Mack?
No.
Commissioner Shiro?
Yes.
Chair Martin?
Yes.
And now on the nomination of John Mack being the chair for the next year, roll call vote, Debbie.
Commissioner Fowler Payne?
Yes.
Commissioner Mack?
Yes.
Commissioner Shiro?
No.
Chair Martin?
No. And with that, I guess I will entertain a motion to table this until our next regular meeting in order so we can have all five of the...
I'll be happy to do that again. I'll make a motion to table until our next meeting.
The meeting when all five commissioners can be present to share their votes.
But we tried.
Well, I think you did a great job. I just think the variety going through.
I've got a motion on the table, and I'm seeking a second.
Second it.
Very good. So we'll just have a voice vote. All in favor of tabling this item to the next meeting when all five commissioners can be present?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes.
Any opposed? Very good. That will be delayed until the next appropriate meeting. Item 10 is a notice of administrative decisions since March 6th. And just a little bit of a notice. Are there any questions or comments on this?
Yeah, I did. Do you
Are they required to post a notification sign on their property for these?
No.
Well, because when I was there, this 176 Pine Street, there were two mailboxes, but there were three houses. And half of these places don't even have addresses on them, so I had no idea which one was even the one that they were proposing for the homestay. Because there was a house in the front, one in the back, and then there was a house here, and the mailboxes were at the property line, and they had two mailboxes, so I had no way of knowing whether it was a house in the back or this house, and that house had no street address on it. So,
but a homestay is a visit within an existing residence, not a separate residence per se. Is that correct?
No, but that's like a vacation kind of homestay thing. But if there's no address and there's no boxes, and they don't post a identification that this is where it's being processed. I mean, I drive over there and I don't even know what I'm looking for. And then I came back and said, okay, I'm going to Google. Well, that didn't work either. So I was just curious if they, I guess they don't have to put a sign out there to
Correct.
Say that we're going to do a homestay.
Correct.
So it makes it kind of hard for us to, you know, for the people who drive to those sites. I don't know. Went, but I couldn't identify where it was. So. Anyway, curious.
Well, as an aside, I'll specifically homestays over even vacation rentals. The intent is you're not even supposed to know what's there. Granted, that doesn't address your address point, which I'll follow up and make sure the address is
obviously
the house is addressed
there,
in compliance with the municipal code. But yeah, that typically homestays. So vacation rentals, after approval, we do notify the neighboring property owners that, hey, there's a vacation rental approved in your neighborhood. Here's the local contact person. Vacation homestays, because it's a property owner, owner-occupied dwelling unit, it really is not supposed to be any different than the existing neighborhood, and that's why the rules are set up that way.
Well, then on vacation rentals, are we doing, because you're saying that you don't post it for homestays, but are they posting it for vacation?
No.
Because I've gone through that same thing with that, too.
Correct.
Okay, it's kind of hard to come in and say, yeah, I approve of that when you can't even find it on the,
yep,
not just in the map, but in the reality.
There's no approval required on a notice of administrative decisions either, though.
No, but you could have a poll if it, I mean, I'm not going to, but you're saying that there's no approval for it, but there is the option for us to pull it if we don't agree with what it is.
That's correct.
So, and I'm not saying I'm doing that. I'm just saying, how do you find these if they're not identified on the site? And, you know, if you spend the time to go out there and visually to see it and see the project, which I made that determination, no matter what comes forward on my green sheet, I go to that site. But you can't find it. Okay. I'm done.
Okay, are there any commission communications at this point?
I think that was what mine was.
Okay. I had, if we're ready to move, I had a couple questions of staff.
And I'm ready to move on to staff communications.
We can do questions under Planning Commission communications or staff communications. I'm happy to do either one.
Well, there are two comments to me. It may come more under a staff communication because I think of the things that we can share. One, our next meeting is going to be canceled because there are a number of us who are going to be off on a planning training event.
Correct.
But the others, I think it might be helpful for those of us on the commission and perhaps even those in the community to get an update on Mr. Anderson's status. I think that might be nice to hear.
Certainly. That's a very great question. So our planning technician, Sam Anderson, has submitted his letter of terminating his employment at the end of April. It is with great joy that I tell you that he was accepted to Columbia University for graduate studies. So he'll be heading to New York to pursue graduate studies there. So a heavy heart that we're losing Sam, but we're very, very proud of where he's going. So very excited for him on that.
Very good. Now, you had a question or a comment or some other staff?
I'm going to miss Sam.
Are you?
He was a terrific asset for the city.
Yeah. I won't say this to his face, but I'll let him watch the very, very bright young man has been grown incredibly in his time here. We're very, very grateful that he spent, the better part of 3 years with us. So we wish him all the best in his future endeavors.
I felt he was very conscientious and concerned and addressed issues anytime I asked him. Are we going to replace him? Is it going to be... You don't have anything potential?
We are looking at all personnel options at this time.
So one of the questions I had, we were looking at the general plan, and, we had the noise element, the circulation element, and all these element and the extra elements that you can have. Do we have the ability to have a water management plan, like a water element? And, what that would entail is, what our water resources are and, the availability of the water and, how much water is slated for all these other projects. So every time people come to the mic, they would already have the answer, like, how can you approve this development without having the appropriate amount of water? Or in their mind, we haven't had rain or we're in a drought or we're in this. Can we put a plan together that would be informational to the public?
Certainly. So we have a number of water infrastructure plans. So those typically live in public works. Our water system master plan, which is more the infrastructure side of it, our urban water management plan, a number of those types of plans are either mandated by the state and required to be updated on a certain basis. But that's an interesting idea of a water element or water resources element or something like that. I don't know that I've heard of that one. I will say the Office of Planning and Research, OPR, at the state did last year put out their updated general plan guidelines. So when you update your general plan elements, here's what you should include, so forth and so on. And I know they have a pretty comprehensive list of optional elements out there. Let me look at that and see if that's something that they've identified either being beneficial or other communities doing. But like I said, typically we see those in standalone documents that are housed at Public Works.
And then another question, because there's some rumblings out there, the Halcyon and the improvements being proposed there and roundabouts and this, that, and the other thing. Is that going to come before this commission?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I'll provide an update on that when you're done with questions.
But, yeah, I would be really interested in hearing about that because people keep coming to me on the street and asking me. I go, I'd have no knowledge and no information yet to share. So.
Well, on that Halcyon, I think, I don't know if it was the last meeting, but there was a comment made that there was a proposed roundabout for the Halcyon and Folks Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on that strategy committee, whatever. And that wasn't, I don't think at that point, and I haven't heard that anything changed, that the only place that was feasible for the roundabout, and because of the alignment of the road, was at Grand and Halcyon, not at Fair Oaks Avenue. And some of the comments on the Fair Oaks Avenue was the fact that you have the grammar school there, and the kids aren't as well-versed on how to access and cross a roundabout when there's no signal there.
Well, without getting too far into it, I'll provide a status update. So, yes, we are. We've had an administrative draft in-house. We've been reviewing it. This is the Halcyon Road Complete Streets Project. It stretches from Highway 101 to Highway 1. It's a multi-jurisdictional effort between us and the county. We were able to get Caltrans grant funding to go after this complete streets plan. So projecting out into the future what our travel demands are going to be specifically on that corridor, keeping in mind there's development happening on the Mesa that travels that roadway, and we're going to have to accommodate them even though they're not originating in our city. So trying to address modes of transportation for all users, so whether it be vehicles, bicycles, pedestrians. In this case, because it is a kind of a shipping lane from the ag fields to the south of us, accommodating those types of vehicles as well. Majority of the segment, we broke it down into four different corridors or segments, because I already use that word, being 101 to Grand Avenue, Grand Avenue to Fair Oaks, Fair Oaks to the Pike, and then the Pike down in the county out to Highway 1. And there's one major difference in there that's at Fair Oaks, where based on the future traffic demands, we can either address those with a signal, which would, or we could address it with a roundabout. So those are kind of the two options on that. Elsewhere between both, between all the corridors and both kind of alternatives, if you look at the roundabout or a signal alternative at that intersection, all the other improvements are proposed to be the same, which would be a road diet, providing bike enhanced bike infrastructure, and addressing pedestrian walkability and that type of thing. So that will be coming to you in the future. We have to get our comments back to the consultant. But it will definitely come before the Planning Commission, before going to council.
And if I'm not mistaken, there's going to be another, at least one more public opportunity for the public to comment. Is that correct?
No. We've had all of our charrettes and things
okay.
With the public, heard a lot of their prioritization of concerns for that corridor, and that out of all of that and the data that we had, obviously, when we bring it to the Planning Commission, the Traffic Commission, and the Council, those will all be open meetings to the public. They'll all be able to comment on it and help the Council ultimately decide which alternative is yeah. most appropriate.
That's a significant project. There's no doubt there'll be a significant interest in it from the community.
Correct.
Very good. If that's it, this meeting is adjourned.